All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and boy, I'm happy to be out here today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Mike Ludwig. Mike is a writer for truthout.org, and he covers the environment, and especially all the oil catastrophes and the offshore drilling that's been going on all over the country as imperialism keeps on going on to rape the planet, all right? So that's Mike Ludwig at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be listening to a conversation I had with A.L. Press. And A.L. is a writer from the New Yorker magazine, and he recently wrote an article called In Madness, In Florida Prisons, Mentally Ill Inmates Have Been Tortured, Driven to Suicide, and Killed by Guards. And in this article, Press tells the story of the horrific death of Darren Rainey, who died after 2 hours in a shower of scalding hot water, boiled to death. And he was not the only prisoner subjected to this form of torture. Prisons are now the dominant mental health institutions in the U.S. This is the story not only of abuse comparable to that in Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib, but of the mental health professionals who are caught in the cover-up of brutality toward the people they are morally and professionally required to protect. This is a great interview, folks, so we're going to jump right into the conversation I had with A.L. Press just a couple of days ago.
I just recently read an article in a recent issue of The New Yorker that just kind of blew my mind. And the article was by A.L. Press, and it was called Madness: In Florida Prisons, Mentally Ill Inmates Have Been Tortured, Driven to Suicide, and Killed by Guards. When I read this, I just had to talk to A.L. A.L., welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What brought you to this story, man? I mean, it's like I said, it's just sort of one of those things that just wraps itself around your brain and squeezes and squeezes and squeezes until you're just like, what?
Well, actually what brought me to it was a conversation about a year ago I had with Jamie Fellner, who works at Human Rights Watch, and at the time was working on a report about the abuse of mentally ill inmates in our prisons. There are 360,000 prisoners in America who have diagnosed mental illness. There's a much larger number that cycle through our nation's jails. And as we were talking, that report has since been published. It's called Callous and Cruel, and it was published several months ago, and it documents the use of force and stun guns and chemical sprays and restraint chairs that are routinely used and used disproportionately to subdue and punish mentally ill prisoners. As we were talking, I became interested in what the people who serve as counselors and psychotherapists and psychologists in prison, what they do when they are witnesses to this kind of behavior. And the reason it's important is that prisons have become, in many states, the dominant mental health institutions. As I wrote in The New Yorker, in Florida, one of the largest mental health institutions today is the Dade County Jail. I wrote about another facility, a correctional facility in Dade County, the Dade Correctional Institution, where, as you mentioned, I discovered that prisoners endured abuses comparable to those people have read about at Guantanamo. And the article deals not only with documenting those abuses and what the inmates endured, but also looking at what the people who were there, who witnessed them and were and are sort of by medical ethics bound to protect their patients, what position they're in. And as I argue in the article, as I try to illustrate, they're sort of caught in a bind, because on the one hand, their medical ethics requires that they report these abuses. On the other hand, in reality, they are beholden to the guards. And so if they report something that the security personnel do not want reported, their own safety can be compromised. And that's really the dynamic that plays out in the article.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you just mentioned something that I really wanted to get into in terms of the comparison to Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib, actually, if you look at that. You know, let's talk about that a little bit more, because for people to get a sense of this, we're talking about, when I read your piece, and I've read other pieces on this and interviewed people that have talked about the kinds of conditions in the prison, and especially in prisons facing mentally ill people. And this actually, more than any, I think, brought home this idea of, it is very, very similar to Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib in terms of the conditions that people were living under.
Well, I think based on what I report, I think that's a very fair comparison in this case. And just to give listeners a sense, so the protagonist of the story is a psychiatric technician who becomes a counselor. Her name is Harriet Krzyzkowski. She enters the prison very much thinking of the guards as the good guys and the inmates as the people she can't trust. From the very start, she witnesses and sees things that disturb her. She hears prisoners complain about not being given meals, about being starved deliberately as punishment. She also witnesses verbal abuse. She reports this to her supervisor, and her supervisor tells her really not to take it seriously and also sort of warns her, says, you know, we need to have a good working relationship with security. Well, she files this away, but she continues to see disturbing things. By the middle of her time there and really further on in my story, she starts to hear about other things, beatings, stompings, and then the story of a prisoner named Darren Rainey, who was a severely schizophrenic 50-year-old prisoner in the mental health ward at Dade. And Mr. Rainey was arrested on a cocaine possession charge. He was pretty close to finishing his sentence, and he was put in the mental health ward of this facility. And Harriet learns that there has been some kind of problem, and he has apparently defecated in his cell. And the guards have told her, well, we'll take care of Rainey. We're going to put him in a shower. And when she first hears this, she thinks the purpose of the shower will be to clean him up and to relax him, perhaps. What she discovers when she returns to prison, to the prison the next day, is that Rainey was locked in a shower that he could not exit, whose water supply was controlled from the outside by the guards. And this water was 180 degrees, that is, scalding water, hot enough to brew a cup of tea. And Rainey was in the shower for about 2 hours, and he died. And when he collapsed on the floor and his body was later found, he had burns on 90% of his body. So again, just to give a sense, when I don't think we should speak lightly of comparisons to the kinds of things people have read about in Guantanamo, but this is the kind of stuff that happened at this prison. And it didn't just happen to Darren Rainey. As I report in the story, we know of at least 8 other inmates at the prison who were also subjected to what was called the shower treatment.
It's almost just, it's very difficult to even process this, that this person was basically boiled alive, which is like just, and the thing is that when you talk about the person who was working there that you spoke with, in fact, what was her name?
Harriet Krzyzkowski.
Yeah, okay. When you spoke with her, there's something that she was wrestling with, because she also was one of the people that talked about having seen this, you were speaking to earlier, about having seen the abuse that was meted out to the mentally ill prisoners, and she was tried to report it or tried to speak to her superior about it. But there was this whole sort of both a concept of, it's true that she not only, it was not just that the authorities sort of turned their heads, but basically, she was actually facing a situation where the guards actually made it clear that if she spoke, she would face retaliation in herself.
That's right. And by the way, we should emphasize that when we say the guards, we're talking about a group of guards who were engaging in sadistic behavior. There were also many guards at Dade who were not doing this. But one of the aspects of the story that is crucial, really, to how these abuses are tolerated and perpetuated is that there's a sort of culture of silence, and no one can speak out. So people who witness things just don't say anything because they will be seen as traitors. And that is precisely what happened to Harriet. So she actually did report one problem she had, which was that she was not being allowed to take the inmates under her care out to the rec yard. And this was a cement quadrangle adjacent to the mental health ward. It was really the only fresh air that a lot of these inmates in the mental health ward got. I mean, they didn't call this a solitary confinement ward, but for all intents and purposes, that's what it was. You had prisoners, you had inmates with mental illnesses locked up for 23 hours a day, sometimes not allowed out at all. So the rec yard was a crucial, crucial activity. And for weeks, she was not allowed on Sundays to take the inmates out to the rec yard. She complained about this, and after she complained about it, she starts realizing that the security gates allowing her to pass from one part of the prison to another are not opening when she buzzes for them to open. In other words, she's standing there waiting for it to open. She's alone with a group of inmates, and she's not getting buzzed through. She starts doing her what were called psychoeducational groups, these counseling groups. And usually there would be a guard by the door outside, actually, who she could see through the window in case anything happened. And she looks up in the middle of one of these, and the guard is gone, and she's alone. And at first she thought, well, he just had to leave. He was called to something. Eventually she comes to realize this isn't an accident. It's happening again and again. And in fact, there is an incident I describe in the story where she's very nearly sexually assaulted. She's left alone in the rec yard one day, and an inmate touches her inappropriately. A psychotic inmate touches her, and she freezes, basically, and then eventually gets away. But as she says in the story, you know, anything could have happened to her at that point.
Yeah, and that's what I was actually leading to, because it really seemed like, you know, basically the guards that do this, there's a certain, you know, there's the thing that you're just talking about where she's actually, the people who would speak up against this are actually, they know, and the message is given to them clearly that pretty much we hold your well-being in our hands. Now, we can push buttons or not push buttons. We can put you in a yard with somebody who's like completely homicidal maniac, or we can actually make sure that those doors are open, or we can actually make sure that you never have any problem with somebody jumping up and assaulting you. But if you go against us and turn us in, this is what's waiting for you. So there's like this sort of extension of what they're doing to the prisoners, to the, what they're doing, how to keep the staff quiet.
That's right. And in fact, there's another psychotherapist whose story I tell in the story, George Mallinckrodt, who eventually starts hearing about beatings and abuse. He reports it, and he reports it directly to the warden at the time. And he thinks the warden seems receptive to it. He thinks there's going to be a change. He shows up at work one day, and the change turns out to be that he's fired officially for taking extended long lunch breaks, which he was taking. But in reality, a lot of people were taking long lunch breaks. It's not an easy job. But Mallinckrodt was the only person who was voicing concern about abuse and reporting it, and he lost his job. So that was another message sent to the staff. I should mention that, you know, given that we're talking about the constraints, you know, and the fact that people knew they would be at risk if they reported anything, it begs the question, how then do we even know that these abuses happened? How do we know that the incident I described involving Darren Rainey in the shower actually occurred? The reason we know it turns out to be that there was a prisoner, an inmate named Harold Hempstead, who occupied a cell directly below that shower, and he ended up reporting it. He first reported it to various state agencies, which, generally speaking, replied very curtly by saying they had received the complaint and they were not taking action. And then eventually, with the help of his sister, Wendy, he reached the Miami Herald, and the Miami Herald published a story in May of 2014 about the death of Darren Rainey. And that kind of opened a window onto what was happening inside this place. Without Harold Hempstead, without that kind of, and this is an inmate, by the way, who has been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, and he was really obsessed with getting the word out on this. He was actually told by staff at the prison, don't do it. You're going to get everybody in trouble. But he went ahead. So if you think about that, you sort of, that to me is one of the most chilling things about the piece. We very easily, but for this, wouldn't know anything about the incidents that are described in my story.
Yeah, it's extremely important. And it's also important for people to understand what has happened to him since then.
That's right. Of course, he gets tagged as the whistleblower because the Miami Herald publishes this story. And so Hempstead, although he's been transferred to another prison, the whistleblower label will be attached to him for as long as he's in the prison system. And that's going to be a very long time because Hempstead is serving a 165-year sentence for involvement in a string of burglaries in his early 20s. Now, keep in mind, that's a 165-year sentence for what admittedly were real crimes. Hempstead says he wasn't directly involved in the burglaries. He says he was only helping to make money off of some stolen goods. I don't know the facts. What is clear is that Harold Hempstead was not accused of murdering anyone. And what he has done since is expose a murder that took place in a prison, which has led to investigations by the Justice Department and other investigations. And yet, he He is stuck in prison. There is no apparent move by the governor of Florida or other authorities there to grant him clemency or do something to mitigate his situation. And that, again, just kind of adds a layer of the surreal to the whole story.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with A.L. Press, who's had a recent article in the, what was it? It was the May 2nd issue of The New Yorker, and it's called Madness. In Florida prisons, mentally ill inmates have been tortured, driven to suicide, and killed by guards. Now, A.L., one of the things, as we're talking, I keep thinking about that old line that's always drawn out to explain sort of, you know, it's sort of like, where they basically say, you know, there's the thin blue line that stands between decent populations and decent citizens and those who would rip you apart to pieces, who would maul you in front of your mother, you know. And it's sort of, it's a thin blue line. It's ugly over there, and we do what's necessary to prevent you from falling into that area where you're going to be assaulted or worse, you know. And it just seems that whole thing gets played out in relation to this, including when these officials that you're talking about, of the prison officials, actually hear about this, it reeks of that sort of sentiment or that thing of the thin blue line between civilized people and all those others.
Well, it should be noted that it's nearly 4 years now. We're approaching the fourth anniversary of Darren Rainey's death. The autopsy explaining the reason for his death has still not been released. It was leaked to the media, however, earlier this year, and the death was ruled accidental. Now, as I suggested in my story, the death may well have been accidental, because the point of what was being done was to torture and abuse, not necessarily to murder. But nevertheless, you have 4 years later, not even an autopsy report released to indicate the reason of death. And no one has been held accountable for what happened. There has been a change in the security personnel within the prison. There have been cameras placed and various other reforms, not least because an organization called Disability Rights Florida sued the Department of Corrections, demanding some changes after all of this was revealed. But in a larger sense, you know, I think that it's important for people who read my story and who think about these issues to think beyond what I think is the easy way to cast blame in a situation like this, and that is to, in a sense, you know, focus exclusively on the handful of guards who were doing the worst of the abuse. Certainly a measure of accountability is required there, but one can make a very strong case, I think, that those guards who are abusing mentally ill prisoners are doing what is predictable and in some ways almost expected in a society that has come to use prisons to warehouse mentally ill people, particularly indigent mentally ill people. And if you think about what the guards face, they are not trained to, in many cases, they're getting some training now, but they weren't before, to treat mentally ill people. The Florida prisons are understaffed. Guards are overworked. The system as a whole this is the third largest prison system in the United States. And an enormous amount of money is spent on the back end incarcerating people. Very little is spent on the front end treating people with mental illnesses so that they don't wind up in the prison system. In fact, Florida is next to last in the country when it comes to spending on mental health services. So you have a situation where it would be very easy to just sort of focus on, oh, these guards, you know, and what they did. And certainly, as I say, you know, the particular incidents are accountability is demanded, investigations are called for, but at a much larger sense, the responsibility belongs to society and to the policymakers who created this situation.
You know, it's interesting because in your piece, you come to a point where you actually go back and you confront some of the prison officials, some of the prison officials at the Dade Correctional Institute have been replaced, and there's people coming in, and then there's other prisons that you went to, and you run into this one person who was in charge of the prison and who was talking about, you know, how, well, things are changed and we pay attention to this and we do this. And then he introduces and he says, we're always kind of receptive to what people have to say to us. And then he introduces someone you had that both, well, actually, not just you, but the person you were talking about earlier, Harriet Kraskowski, you know,
yes,
that she ran into this Dr. Perez, and then you had a run-in with Dr. Perez, and then Dr. Perez meets you, and she's being put forward as someone who really understands and is working for the good of it all, you know, and I was really kind of smacked in the head by your run-in with her.
Right. Well, you're not alone. That's right. I tried independently to interview Dr. Perez. She was the supervisor of Harriet Krzyzkowski and several other psychotherapists and counselors who I interviewed. They all told me the same thing, which is that her attitude was, you know, get along with security, don't rock the boat. If you reported abuse, she was either silent or she discouraged such reporting. This is what the sources I spoke to said. I wanted to hear her point of view. She elected not to talk to me. Then I visited the prison, and I was, by chance, introduced to her. She was still in charge. Her position had not changed, even though the whistleblower I mentioned, George Mallinckrodt, had been fired. So afterwards, I asked the official who took me around whether he really felt things had changed in light of the fact that, you know, complaints had been voiced about this this person, and he sort of brushed it off as, well, you know, it's a disgruntled ex-employee, namely George Mallinckrodt, who lost his job. As I point out in the piece, I heard the same thing from various sources. Now, again, if we look, you know, again, if we want to extend the circle beyond sort of the individuals involved, you know, Dr. Perez is probably made this a calculation that it will help her to not rock the boat. And her employer, by the way, is not the Department of Corrections. It is a private for-profit company named Wexford, because all of the mental health services in Florida have been privatized. And that decision was made in 2013, and it has led to extremely substandard care. And as I say in the article, one of the problems with entrusting a for-profit company to do this kind of work is that they then, you know, if they report abuse and they, you know, sort of indicate that there are problems to the Department of Correction, well, it might create a problem with the contract that they want to hold on to. Why would they want to, you know, air dirty laundry and talk about all the problems going on? So there are all these negative incentives that exist, and as a consequence, you have a situation where, there is very little accountability and, unfortunately, very little reporting of improper conduct.
Mm-hmm. I have two more questions, and one of them is, you know, I told you earlier I had interviewed Mary Buser, who's the author of Lockdown at Rikers. In her career at Rikers Island, towards the end of it, she actually was the person who was in charge of this place where a lot of the mentally ill patients, or a lot of mentally ill prisoners were being held. And one of the big things was solitary confinement and the use of solitary confinement to really, you know, hammer down on these prisons for the slightest things, for punishment, for torture, for whatever. And Mary was somebody who went into this right out of college, and she was just so into it, and she was so, you know, moral, and she was really, there was nothing going to sway her. But as she stayed in the job, there was something that happened because of the kind of the culture that actually grows up around all this, where she was able to close her eyes to a lot of the stuff that would have outraged her and moved her to, like, you know, sort of be charging at the doors with telephone poles, pitchforks, and torches. And she talks about one time when this guy had been beaten up when they were trying to extract him from solitary confinement. He had defecated all over the walls and all this stuff. And so when they went in, they savagely beat him. And she was talking to a doctor, and the doctor said, she's saying, you don't have to really report all of this. You don't have to report all of this. And the doctor says, they broke his neck. And she says, it was only one bone. And it was a bone he doesn't even need. And the doctor dropped his little pad there, and he dropped it on the floor, turned around, walked away, never to be seen again. And she ended up, it suddenly struck her, she ended up going back to her office and crying for hours, because it suddenly struck her that it wasn't just all of the other people, but that actually she herself had made peace with the way things were, an uneasy peace, but peace nonetheless, that allowed her to look beyond what was really in front of her eyes, what was really going on. How often do you think that happens in a place like what you were talking about in these correctional institutes in Florida?
I think it happens all the time. I think that's the normal, in some ways, maybe the typical human response. You know, people are shocked by it at first. They may test out what might happen if they report it, as Harriet Krzyzkowski did. They find out that's not encouraged, and it could get you in huge trouble and also endanger you. And so adjustments are made, and people engage in self-silencing. It's predictable, and it's a very unfortunate when you have a situation that punishes people for behaving ethically. You end up doing that, and so that's a very powerful story, and it very much resonates with with what I heard going on in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my last question. It's Dostoevsky said the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. So what do you say about that in terms of what you've entered the prison? Let's talk about the degree of civilization in a society.
Well, I would encourage, I think my article speaks for itself as to how I feel about that. You know, the article is titled Madness, and the madness, I think, exists, and you know, that sort of metaphor rings true on many levels. It's madness that we imprison, that we have, in a sense, made homelessness and mental illness and this whole sort of population, we've criminalized and are warehousing people with schizophrenia and other mental health problems who need treatment, who could be, if they receive treatment, who might be able to live productive lives. And instead, we leave them to fend for themselves, and they get funneled into the criminal justice system. It becomes an enormous expense, and it's also cruel and inhumane. So, you know, that's sort of my answer to Dostoevsky's observation. And again, it's summarized in the word madness.
Mm-hmm, exactly. All right, A.L. Press, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Sure. Take care now.
Great. Thanks.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with A.L. Press. And A.L. wrote an article in the May 2nd issue of New Yorker magazine, and the article is entitled Madness. In Florida prisons, mentally ill inmates have been tortured, driven to suicide, and killed by guards. It's not an article to miss, folks. Really, rush out, get this, get it online, read it. It's really an eye-opener, and it's enraging, all right? It's really enraging. And then when you're done reading it, you too can talk about and you can think about Dostoevsky's statement. But let's amend it a little bit. Let's talk about what kind of society this actually is. What do these prisons actually say about what kind of society we live in and we tolerate, and how long are we going to tolerate it? We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Bomb the Tracks by Chuckie Weiss from his album Red Beans and Weiss. We're going to listen to a talk I had earlier this week with Mike Ludwig from truthout.org, writing about the oil industry, fracking, and raping the earth. So with no further ado, let's listen to my conversation with Mike Ludwig. I've recently started reading the work of a guy who writes for truthout.org, and he's been covering a lot of what's been happening in the Gulf of Mexico, in Louisiana, in relation to oil and the raping of the planet for oil. And he's been actually doing some really remarkable work. And I wanted to talk with him about what's going on, because so much is concentrated up in what happened in relation to the planet, the future of the planet, and what the system is doing to the earth. So Mike Ludwig, welcome to the show, man.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. And I was serious, man. I really appreciate your work. So let's jump into the first question. In mid-April, the Obama administration announced that its offshore drilling plan for 2017 to 2022. And this was in the aftermath of the Paris conference and all this. And they came out with this big plan. What was it?
Well, this is basically the Department of the Interior's plan for lease options in the next 5 years, 2017 to 2022. So basically what the federal government does is every 5 years, it plans out how these auctions are going to roll out. And then they have regular auctions with the oil and gas industry for large chunks of the ocean. For this offshore drilling plan, The two places where auctions will be held is in the Gulf of Mexico and in Arctic waters off of Alaskan coasts. Basically, the federal government controls a lot of the ocean beyond 3 miles from shore. Often states will have control of waters within 3 miles from shore. But after that, the Interior Department and the federal government owns those waters. So to bring in some revenue off of the hydrocarbons and the potential hydrocarbons that are out there, they'll lease big chunks of these to oil and gas companies. And then they get to go out there and spend several years developing wells and putting up oil drilling platforms and then producing oil and gas. So that's basically how that works. The Obama administration basically, on its way out, is leaving a 5-year plan to continue those type of auctions in the Gulf specifically and in the Arctic. Where they're not having auctions is in the Pacific and the Atlantic. And originally, the Atlantic Ocean was, which really isn't any offshore drilling there, it was on the 5-year plan. They had proposed to do this, but there was such an outcry on the East Coast that they scrapped that plan. And there's been a lot of drilling already in the Gulf, and has been for years. And in the Arctic, Shell has been exploring up there, so that's another area of interest.
Well, you know, one of the things around the Arctic that really got me too, though, was that it seemed like there had been this sort of pullback at a certain point where so much was happening that people had warned about, that so many things were developing in the direction that people had been warning about. And this sort of, it seemed like there might have been a backup, you know, after some of the mishaps with Shell in the Arctic. And I was curious about this because at a certain point, it was like, I think there was sort of a general letting your breath out because it seemed like, okay, Shell pulled out. All this was going back to a quiet era. But now you're talking about two things. You're talking about the possibility of renewing the drilling in the Arctic and expanding and putting in new things in the Gulf of Mexico. Both places, very, very, very important to the oil industry, but extremely important in terms of what any mishap there could do to the planet. What's behind this?
Well, I think there might be oil there, so they obviously want to go get it. But people are very concerned. I mean, just over the weekend, there was a big protest in Washington, D.C. against this 5-year plan. And it was led by people from communities, often Native communities in Alaska. And it was led by environmental justice advocates from the Gulf. And the Gulf is saying enough is enough. We already live around a lot of oil and gas infrastructure. There's a threat to the water offshore. There's pollution onshore from the processing, the piping of it, and it's often ending up, you know, a lot of this infrastructure ends up being placed in low-income and communities of color. They've had enough of that. And in the Arctic, there hasn't been as much production, successful production up there. However, it would require a lot of infrastructure to get that going, and not everyone who lives up there is excited about new pipelines being built and trucks rolling into town with new equipment. Also, some people up there are probably excited about the idea of getting jobs. So it's complicated, but definitely people on the front line of this controversy are very much leading the movement against it right now because they're going to bear the brunt of the impact.
Tell me this. I think one of the reports I first read of yours had to do with a meeting that occurred in, mid-March? And it was actually the thing that was talking about fitting off different parcels of the ground underneath the ocean to drill for oil, to bring more in. And it was covering everything. So what seemed to be happening at this auction was that there was an attempt to sell off more and more territory in terms of being able to drill for oil. And I was kind of curious about this because there was some recognition on a large part of the population of the dangers of doing this. And yet they go ahead with this. And I was wondering, did they auction things off at this meeting? You know, aside from just talking about it, did they actually auction things off, and how much was auctioned off?
You're talking about the meeting in New Orleans where there was a protest that kind of interrupted it.
Yes.
Absolutely right. So this is one of the lease auctions I was talking about, and this one was just part of the 5-year plan that was set 5-6 years ago. But it was interrupted by a large group of protesters. But, yeah, they leased off some... I'm going to look for the numbers right now, but they did lease off large portions of the Gulf during this time, but not nearly as much as they usually do with these type of things, as much as they have in the past. And that's partially because oil prices are low and companies aren't so excited about making these investments right now. But yeah, millions of acres are up for grabs when these auctions happen. That doesn't mean that they'll all get bought, but that's basically how it works. During that specific auction, it looks like nearly 700,000 acres of the Gulf were bid on and probably bought out. but, you know, millions were up for grabs because we're talking about a pretty large area. So what you get if you're an oil company and you bid on one of these plots out in the Gulf, you just get a large, big square, the ocean, to go out there, and that's yours to work on to try to get hydrocarbons out of.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mike Ludwig, who is a writer for truthout.org, and Mike covers the drilling for oil, the oil leasing, the U.S. government selling off of oil leases, the drilling of oil, and all the catastrophes that jump up off of that. Now, Mike, basically this has happened, as I read it, it's happened 8 times in relation to the Gulf of Mexico alone since 2012. Is that true?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how many auctions they've had since 2012. I feel like there might be, there are several, and they happen at least about once a year. So I think 8 might be a little high. Maybe it's about once or twice a year. It usually happens here in New Orleans. I'm not sure how many they've had. I have to look that up on their website. But this does happen regularly, right? I mean, it's usually planned out. I'm not sure what the schedule is for the current 5-year plan and the next 5-year plan. But every year or so, they will hold at least one of these. And they'll hold it in the area that they're auctioning out. So, you know, they have it down here in New Orleans that they're auctioning off plots in the Gulf of Mexico. If they were doing it in California, they would probably hold it someplace in California. But it looks like most of the federal waters in California are already leased out. So,
now, one of the things I read in one of your articles involved fracking. And I personally just didn't know about fracking being carried out in the ocean. What's happening with that?
Right. So we didn't know very much about ocean fracking until about 2013. I had heard a few things about it. And environmentalists had heard a few things about it, but we weren't sure really where it was happening. But there were some kind of rumors about it going on off the coast of California, actually right off the coast of Santa Barbara in California. And when I asked federal regulators about it, they didn't really give me a lot of information. So I ended up filing a pretty broad FOIA request, a Freedom of Information request, with the federal regulators. And then I got a lot of information back, including that they were using fracking technology in the Santa Barbara Channel, that there had been several permits given out for this to happen. Now, this caused quite an uproar in California. People were not happy to hear about fracking in the ocean since they were already very concerned about fracking coming to California onshore. Since then, we've learned a lot more about that technology that's commonly used in the ocean. It's typically smaller in scale than the unconventional fracking that happens onshore. But still, environmentalists have a lot of concerns about it, including impact seismic faults, what happens to the chemical-laced wastewater after these fracking operations occur. And as we tried to learn more about it, it was still very difficult to get information from the federal government about how they were regulating offshore fracking, because it turned out that they were permitting this technology to be used under categorical exclusions, which basically allow them to permit it to happen on permit modifications without subjecting the use of this technology to any kind of formal environmental review process that is accessible to the public. And that created a lot of controversy as well. So I've actually been waiting to hear. We asked the government where they are fracking in the Gulf of Mexico, where fracking has actually been used much more often, especially in recent years. That's called, they use it for well completion, which means that it kind of helps them get the end of what's left in a well out and helps them close the well up and stuff like that. And they still weren't exactly sure where it had happened because they didn't track it on their permit database. So I've been waiting for a lawsuit to conclude with an environmental group based out of California. And we're just now getting some of these documents in. Hopefully we're going to be learning a lot more about how the government regulates fracking in the ocean, how that works, and exactly where it's taking place, especially in the Gulf of Mexico. In the years since my FOIA in California, we've learned a lot more about where fracking occurs in California's waters. But getting that information about the Gulf of Mexico has taken legal challenges. It's taken FOIA requests. And we're just now learning about it. So going to be, you can look for more stories on this in the future, because I'm just getting some of this information now.
And just one more question on that. Just how dangerous is fracking? And what would happen if, like, there was an accident with fracking? How dangerous is it, and what would it do?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. When I talk to the industry, and often when I read the regulatory documents around fracking, the industry will tell you that it's safe and that it's very small in scale compared to fracking onshore. But environmentalists think it's very dangerous, and they don't think that it should be categorically excluded from environmental review. And they're especially concerned about the discharge of produced waters, because all fracking, you know, uses fluids to break up underground or undersea rock under high pressure, right? And there's proppants in there, little bits of sand or silica that will hold the rocks open. That's kind of how it works. A lot of this stuff comes back through the drilling infrastructure. What happens to that water? Is it being injected underground waste wells? Is it being dumped overboard? There's a lot of questions that we still need to answer about how this technology is impacting the environment, since it actually hasn't had a formal environmental review that's been subject to public notice and public comment. And then, you know, that process, if that were somehow mandated, would answer a lot of these questions, you know, find out if the industry is correct. Maybe this is kind of just another benign well completion technique that's used regularly and safely, or environmentalists suspect something that could actually pose serious threats to the environment, especially if something goes wrong. And often we find that in offshore drilling, things do go wrong. I mean, there was just an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last week. I believe cleanup is probably just finishing up just about now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mike Ludwig, who is a writer for truthout.org. And Mike covers the drilling for oil, the oil leasing, the U.S. government selling off of oil leases, the drilling of oil, and all the catastrophes that jump up off of that. Tell me this. You've talked about this offshore leasing, this whole thing that's connected up around that. You've talked about it as a corporate giveaway. Why?
Well, these are essentially waters that are controlled by the government, right? I mean, this is the government that we vote for, the government that we pay taxes to, and they are leasing a public resource to private companies. And the private companies are making a lot of money pulling hydrocarbons out of these areas. Drilling for oil is kind of like pulling money out of the ground. And, you know, the government does bring in some revenue for itself by leasing these areas out, but they still are waters that essentially belong to the taxpayer, to people that live here. And they're going into private hands. And then people get angry when those same companies cause pollution in their communities.
Just out of curiosity, how much of the oil reserves are actually offshore?
You know, I'm not sure about the answer to that question. I do know that environmentalists have argued that if we are to meet the Paris Agreement, if we're going to meet the emission levels set forth by the recent climate agreement in Paris, then most of our offshore reserves must stay in the ground. I do think that most of the reserves in the United States, if I can remember correctly, are currently in private hands, but a good chunk of them are offshore and, you know, in public land or in public waterways, which is essentially deep water in the ocean.
Just a couple more questions here. Basically, and you started to speak to this, but could you dig a little bit more into this, what difference it would make to keep the U.S. oil reserves in the ground in terms of carbon emissions and all the dangers that we're facing as a planet today? What difference would it make to actually keep these things in the ground?
Well, if you kept these things in the ground, we'd be forced to switch to renewables much faster because we wouldn't have these reserves coming up, and it would change the oil market in a lot of different ways. But, you know, environmentalists who are pushing for that kind of what they call a just transition to renewables, they're saying that we've got to keep this in the ground now to get that change started. And if we produce these hydrocarbons now, they're going to get burned eventually. And there's a point to which, you know, you produce enough of this stuff, it's going to get burned, and then we're going to have 1 degree to 2 degrees of global warming as opposed to a half a degree. And that's the kind of increments that they're looking at. And they estimate that the majority of the reserves in the United States need to stay in the ground for us to meet the Paris Agreement, for us to meet our obligations under the Paris Agreement. They say that the majority of those need to stay in the ground. And that's a lot, you know what I mean? There's still a lot of reserves left in this country. We only started exploiting a lot of our onshore reserves in the past 5 years because of unconventional fracking. But they're saying that the majority of that should definitely stay in the ground. That's why they've named their movement the Keep It in the Ground movement. That's often something, slogan you hear at protests.
Now, just to be clear, the U.S., it's not like the U.S. doesn't have the ability to do this, right? They do actually have the ability to transition to 100% renewable energy relatively quickly. Is that true? And if so, what difference would it make to the planet?
I think it would make a huge difference to the planet, absolutely. And also what it would do is set a big example for other industrial nations. If we started a very aggressive transition and it was successful, our innovations worked, and the renewables we were tapping into were working for us, then other countries would look at us and say, hey, that is possible. Maybe we can do what the United States does. And we would have technology that we developed around this to share with other countries. And that's one of the reasons why scientists are really excited about this, because, you know, they want to see the government spend money on this, because if we can develop the technology here, then we can share it with China, where coal is being burned in massive amounts and is causing smog everywhere. You know, China's become one of the most major carbon emitters in the world, and if we can start sharing this technology we develop here with China and other developing countries, especially a lot of developing countries, right? They're unhappy about having to meet climate accords. They're just starting to tap into some of the luxuries that come with massive fossil fuel development, and we've had them for years. Why should they miss out on the boat? So if we can develop the technology here and share with other people, it'd be a really big deal. Now, is that possible? Basically, you've got environmentalist-friendly scientists making models for how this could work, right? And according to them, it's certainly possible. I'm sure there's other people in the scientific community that disagree with their modeling, but there are several scientific models out there for how this could roll out over the next 20, 30 years. And they think with a combination of geothermal, water, wind, and solar, essentially, we could have a pretty clean transition from fossil fuels, you know, within the century. But like I said, they're coming from a certain wing in the scientific community, and I'm sure there's other researchers out there that would disagree with their model or think that this would actually have a much heavier impact on the economy than the climate scientists are saying it would.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mike Ludwig, who is a writer for truthout.org, and Mike covers the drilling for oil, the oil leasing, the U.S. government selling off of oil leases, the drilling of oil, and all the catastrophes that jump up off of that. You know, one thing that popped into my head as you're speaking, one of the things I think that stands in the way of this as well, the entire economy of the U.S. is not only based on the pumping out of oil and all this, but actually if you look at like the biggest user of oil in the world is the U.S. military. And to change to something else, to change to some other kind of fuel, it would actually require revamping their entire military setup all over the world, as well as all the other things in the infrastructure. But particularly that would leave them fairly vulnerable at a certain point. And that was because I was going to ask you, like, okay, what do you think stands in the way? And as I'm thinking about that, this is certainly one of the things, as well as the drive for profit. Everything they do is based on that. I mean, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty big picture stuff, but oil is so much of our infrastructure, and like you said, including our military infrastructure, and even the, you know, the geopolitical moves that our country makes is based around oil. We've seen that over and over again, and it's really the main source of fuel for the whole world. So transitioning away from it, it might be more difficult than some environmentalists want to admit, but one of the reasons why they're telling us we have to do it now, because if we don't get started, you know, this is going to be a really big task, and we've got to start working on it as soon as possible. Of course, there would be resistance in some areas, and I could see why the military would be very resistant to having to switch to using solar panels or something like that. It would also maybe change the way that we interacted with other countries if we weren't using oil as much. So, yeah, I could see that being a problem going forward.
All right. Well, Mike Ludwig, thank you very much for joining us today. And you have a new article coming out soon?
Yeah, we have an article up today on Truth Out, and it covers a recent oil spill in the Gulf that happened last week. Shell Oil spilled about 88,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. I talked to a photographer who flew over the oil spill, and it just so happened that this past weekend there had been organized a large anti-offshore drilling protest in Washington, D.C., and those protesters were absolutely energized by the terrible news of this oil spill in the Gulf. And so if you'd like to read about that, you can check it out at truthout.org.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and talk to you again soon. Bye now.
All right, bye.
All right, we've just been talking with Mike Ludwig, a reporter for truthout.org, and we've been talking about his recent coverage of the U.S. moves to step up, to continue and step up their selling of oil leases in the Gulf of Mexico, off of California, and in the Arctic Ocean, all of which is extremely dangerous and could spell the end of the planet. All right, so keep your eyes on all of this. All right, I got a special treat for you now. After listening to this part of today's show, I thought it would be more than appropriate to listen to a piece from Bob Avakian. Now, this piece is taken from his DVD, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the piece is called Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth. All right, once again, this is Bob Avakian. Check this out.
Let's look a little more fully at the history of this system, its crimes all over the world, as well as within the U.S. itself. Look at what their system is doing to the earth, how it is wrecking the environment. In places like Brazil, as well as in places in Africa and Asia, there are beautiful rainforests, full of a rich diversity of species which are being torn down and destroyed by the ever-hungry engine of this system. These are not just short-term effects. This has a long-term effect on the environment, not just in those places, but all over the world. And it has an effect on the people, too. For example, in Brazil, indigenous people, whose way of life was based on living in the rainforest, wake up one day to see a bulldozer knocking down the trees 100 yards from where they've always lived. And what's the result of this? Many of them can no longer go on living the way they were before. And one of the things that happens is many of the young women go into the cities in Brazil to become prostitutes because that's the only way they can survive. And now we have people like Bush and them talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. Once again, hungry for oil without regard to the environment or the effects on the people for generations to come. At the same time, they're breaking or refusing to sign agreements on the environment, on global warming, backing out of these agreements if they made them in the first place. Once again, these are not just so-called isolated incidents they always tell us about, the few rotten apples. This is what they have done and are doing to the environment throughout the U.S. and all over the world. To take one outrageous example of this, within the memory of many people alive today, the U.S. government carried out testing of nuclear weapons, bringing contamination and poisoning of people even inside this country itself, along with the devastation and the driving out of the whole population of the Bikini Islands in the Pacific during the late 1940s and 50s. Because of this nuclear testing in their home was no longer livable for them. Now, recently I was reading an essay called Disarming Images about an exhibit of art for nuclear disarmament, which was held in the early 1980s. And I noticed that the author of this essay points out that according to the dictionary, Webster's Third International Dictionary, the name bikini, given to the bathing suit, comes from comparing, quote, the effects of a scantily clad woman to the effects of an atomic bomb, unquote. When you think about this, and you think about the horrendous death, destruction, mutilation, and suffering alive before dying that was caused by the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, and what would result from the much more powerful nuclear weapons these monsters have today, when you think about all that, and you think about the reasons for naming the bikini after all that, and what kind of view of women this promotes, do you need any other proof of how sick this system is and how sick is the dominant culture it produces and promotes? And speaking again of the environment, now they are not only gutting environmental protection laws and safeguards in the U.S. itself, they are insisting that governments everywhere in the world do the same. They are declaring that even limited attempts at environmental protection are an unfair obstacle to free trade. In other words, it is in the way of their endless rampage for more profit, without regard or consideration to the cost for humanity, in this generation and for generations to come. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now, while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. As our party's draft program makes clear, these people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, and that was taken from his DVD, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can find that at revolutiontalk.net. You can also go to revcom.us and check out the page on Bob Avakian, check out a lot of his different works, and also check out the Revolution newspaper and all the very important articles and revolutionary materials that you'll find necessary in the world today. And so once again, that was Bob Avakian, and the title of the piece was Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth. All right, well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, AOL Press and Mike Ludwig. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Brenner, and Matt Kwiklinski. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation. Talk to you again next week.